This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the first weekend of July 2020. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. A mandatory masking requirement in parts of Texas.
We just need everyone to do their part to help to slow the spread.
San Marcos City Council promises to do more to address police brutality and criminal justice reform.
San Marcos is not Minneapolis. It's not Atlanta. It's not many of the cities where we've seen these extreme actions occur. But, of course, it is a city with law enforcement, and there are discrepancies.
And criminal justice policy is at the forefront in the runoff for Travis County Attorney.
Well, let's start with years of experience. I am a 27-year attorney with a double board certification.
They're less concerned about how many years somebody has been a lawyer and more concerned about what kind of leader can you be.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. It's been a brutal week for COVID-19 cases in Texas. The daily case totals are getting higher. On certain days, they're breaking records. We're seeing 8,000 positive tests a day reported statewide. Across Texas, we have so far 183,000 cases of coronavirus confirmed. And of those, about 87,000 are active cases.
So we need to refocus on slowing the spread. But this time, we want to do it without closing down Texas again.
That's Texas Governor Greg Abbott this week talking about ICU units in some areas at or near capacity. And he finally heeded the calls of many local public officials to issue a statewide order mandating that people in counties with more than 20 cases wear face coverings in public.
One of the best ways to keep businesses open while also slowing the spread is for everyone to wear a face covering like this when they go out. Medical studies have shown that wearing a face covering slows the spread of COVID-19 and it protects you and your family. That is why today I am issuing a face covering requirement for all counties with more than 20 COVID cases. This safe standard requires Texans to wear masks in public spaces with certain common sense exceptions.
Here are some of those exceptions. You do not have to wear a mask if you're under 10 years old, if you have a medical condition or disability that prevents wearing a mask, if you're exercising outdoors or going on a walk and maintaining a safe distance from other people who are not in the same household as you. If you're driving around in a car, you don't have to wear a mask. If you're obtaining a service that requires temporary removal of the face covering for security surveillance or screening or some kind of need to access the face, like if you're visiting a bank, the teller needs to look at your face to compare it against your ID. Also, if you're in any swimming pool or a lake, you don't have to wear a mask. If you're voting or helping a voter, you don't have to wear a mask. If you are actively providing or obtaining access to religious worship, you don't have to wear a mask, but it is strongly encouraged. Any person who is giving a speech for broadcast or to an audience does not have to wear a mask. So what happens if you disobey this rule?
This requirement is not intended to be punitive. Instead, we just need everyone to do their part to help to slow the spread. That's why the first violation of the standard is just a warning. Subsequent violations are subject to a penalty not to exceed $250. But let me be clear. No one can ever be put in jail for violating this safe practice. Local law enforcement has the authority to enforce this safety standard just like they do when enforcing seatbelt standards.
The Texas Democratic Party responded, saying this mask order is too little, too late. They issued a statement saying, quote, "It took Texas Democrats demanding that he issue this common sense policy and record-breaking cases and hospitalizations to get Governor Abbott to finally act," end quote. And meanwhile, top public health officials in Austin have been concerned about 4th of July weekend and people doing their own social gatherings. Stephanie Hayden is director of Austin Public Health, and she pleaded with people to stay home.
I know sometimes individuals think that, well, I can just invite over 4 or 5 people that don't live with you. And you may not think that that's a bad idea. It is not a good idea. If the individuals do not live with you, then try a new tradition. Share that new tradition before the 4th of July. Create a space of, these are some things that you can do with your family, with the individuals that live in your home.
Coronavirus cases in Austin continued their upward trend this week. The total number of cases in Travis County so far surpassed 10,000. But the metric most closely watched by the city of Austin's top doctor, interim health authority, Mark Escott, is this, the 7-day moving average of hospitalizations. He says if that 7-day moving average of new people being admitted to the hospital goes over 70, he will recommend a lockdown. He doesn't have the authority to order one without the governor's approval, but he says he will recommend one. Right now, that moving average is just under 60, so we are getting close. But Dr. Escott says that's not the only thing he's looking at.
I will have to say that I'm concerned about something else. I'm concerned about our neighbors in San Antonio and Bexar County, who are reporting more than 1,000 cases a day right now, who have substantial stress on their healthcare system with more than 1,000 patients hospitalized right now. If our neighbors are in stress and they exceed their capacity, it seems likely that overflow of those patients may come to Travis County and our surrounding jurisdictions. So this cannot be just a Travis County, City of Austin issue. This is a state issue. And certainly we have to also look at what's going on around the state and to our neighbors in San Antonio to determine if we have to make a decision earlier.
Now, today, Friday, Austin Mayor Steve Adler issued an order prohibiting any outdoor gatherings of more than 10 people. He did this after Governor Abbott gave local officials the authority to do so this week. So I spoke about it with Adler and asked him about the order.
The order that I just issued took fullest use of the new tools that the governor's order gave to cities. First, we reinforced his message that masks are now mandatory of everyone, and individuals can be fined if they're not appropriately wearing masks. And then second, we have prohibited any gatherings greater than 10 to the fullest extent that the governor's order allows. We did that because in Austin, we're facing right now one of the steepest trajectories of new cases, of ICU cases. And unless we do something behaviorally to change the trajectory, we're going to be inundating our hospitals and putting our doctors and nurses at risk as soon as 2 weeks from now.
We also have the masking order in effect with fines up to $250. How enforceable is that by the city of Austin?
Well, these orders are mostly enforceable by what we expect of one another. When people walk into a room and no one else is wearing a mask, they're less inclined to wear one. They walk into a room and a lot of people are already wearing masks and they'll put on a mask as well. We had a mandatory masking provision back in March and April. It worked really well. And we never had to have a fine or put anybody in jail. But just having it be mandatory, just having the governor now say that it's so important it needs to be mandatory and enforceable, sends a very different message and earns a much higher compliance rate.
Should people be reporting unmasked individuals to 311?
You know, they should be reporting where they think it's being abused. So yes, mostly we're looking for big gatherings that are in violation. We're looking for stores that are not requiring it of customers. And if we get calls from multiple calls from a certain place, then there'll be an enforcement visit. But there are not enough police officers or code enforcement officers or deputy sheriffs to enforce our way to compliance. This has got to be something that the community wants and by its actions creates compliance.
Does the governor's order have anything in it that you disagree with, that you think it doesn't go far enough or maybe goes too far?
I think the governor has too many exceptions to his mask ordinance. I think that we should still require it in things like churches. I think that the governor has too many exceptions to the groups that can gather in excess of 10. That the city doesn't have the ability to be able to restrict.
This weekend, of course, is the 4th of July. Any message for people this weekend in Austin, considering it's a holiday?
I think the fact that this July 4th is a holiday makes our actions that much more important. We saw what happened in Memorial Day and the spike in infections that occurred thereafter. On July 4th, when we are contemplating and remembering and celebrating our freedoms, this July 4th, it's a time to reflect that our way of life requires selfless acts, and there's going to be no truer celebration of July 4th than our community maintaining the discipline and the focus to mask, to avoid groups, in order to be able to best protect our community.
Mayor Adler, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
The Austin Police Department will stop ticketing and arresting people for small amounts of marijuana. KUT's Audrey McGlinchey has that.
In January, Austin City Council members asked Police Chief Brian Manley to quit citing and arresting people for low-level marijuana cases. He said no. Having weed on you was still against the state law. 6 months later, he's changed his mind. Here's Councilmember Greg Kassar, who wrote the resolution in January.
Although the police chief should have made this change the day after City Council passed my resolution directing this in January, it finally happened today because of continued community advocacy.
Council members argued that citing and arresting people was a waste of resources. That's because last summer the state passed a new hemp law. The law distinguished marijuana from hemp. Marijuana, under the state law, has at least 0.3% of THC, the thing that gets you high. Prosecutors in Travis County and elsewhere in the state said they didn't have the resources to test THC levels. So, as of last June, thousands of people cited for pot possession have been turned away from the court. Now, they won't even have a reason to show up. Audrey McGlinchey, KUT News.
It's been a month since San Marcos became the first city in Texas to pass a cite and release law aimed at keeping people out of jail for minor offenses by ticketing them instead of arresting them. Criminal justice advocates say it reduces the overcriminalization of Black and Hispanic residents in Hays County. As KUT's Rianne Roldan reports, now advocates are pushing for cite and release in other nearby cities, and San Marcos wants the county to move on a separate, similar program.
Tina Piñales was born and raised in San Marcos. She works a lot with kids, both as a postpartum doula, helping new mothers care for their infants, and as a teacher at a local church. She said she does a lot of little things.
You know, I've been interested in education. I've been interested in the medical field.
But Piñales has been limited. More than a decade ago, when she was a teenager, Piñales was arrested for having a small amount of marijuana. She's 29 now. And though she's put the experience behind her mentally, having an arrest on her record has made it difficult for her to get a full-time job or further her education.
Whenever you're going through that interview process and there's that little box that says, have you been arrested? And you check that, there's instantly a stigma attached to that.
Though Piñales has found ways to make the best of her situation, she still doesn't have the kind of stability afforded by a full-time job.
There's nothing backing me right now. You know, like I don't have health insurance right now. I don't have a 401k. There's nothing substantial like that that I can rest assured in. I won't let it stop me, but I do fear for, you know, if anything were to happen to me and I did need a safety net, there's no net there because the net doesn't want me because I have this thing on my record.
Today, Binales would have never been arrested. She would have been issued a ticket. And that's because of San Marcos's new law requiring officers to issue citations for low-level offenses, just like the one Binales committed. San Marcos City Councilmember Mark Rockymore is the chair of the council's Criminal Justice Committee. He worked on bringing the law to fruition last year. He took note of its timing. Just days after it officially went into effect on June 1st, the nation erupted in protests over police brutality and systemic racism in law enforcement. Rockymore says it was sobering to know that the city was already working on reforms that people across the country are now demanding more of.
San Marcos is not Minneapolis. It's not Atlanta. It's not many of the cities where we've seen these extreme actions occur. But, of course, it is a city with law enforcement, and there are discrepancies.
He points to the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, who was being arrested for a counterfeit $20 bill, which is a misdemeanor.
The officer who went up to George Floyd in that case, if he would have been in San Marcos, he wouldn't have moved toward George Floyd in any way other than someone who's about to issue you a citation, because arrest would not have been an option.
Now San Marcos is calling on Hayes County to take the law a step further with another program called Cite and Divert. It's similar to Cite and Release. People who get citations can meet with a prosecutor to see if they're eligible to take an educational course or complete community service. The county has to give the okay for Cite and Divert because it involves the district attorney's office.
I think that we have a lot of work to do here in Hayes County, and that our county commissioners need to go ahead and jump back into the fray and make these shifts.
Rockymore also says that his work has just begun. He says the protests against police violence and systemic racism have started fading from the news, but we can't go back to the way things have been.
The world is never going to go back to the way it was before everybody watched that 8-minute and 46-second video of George Floyd being murdered on video. The world can't go back to normal.
Rhianne Roldan, KUT News.
Early voting for the March primary runoff election is underway now, and one of the statewide races on the ballot is for Railroad Commissioner of Texas. But as KUT's Mo's Bouchel reports, the two candidates have very little to say about railroads.
That's because the Railroad Commission doesn't have anything to do with railroads. The name is an anachronism from the 1800s. Instead, the three-person commission regulates the Texas oil and gas industry. Because of that, it's been called one of the most powerful government agencies you might have never heard of. Krista Castaneda is one of the two Democrats running for the nomination to compete in the November election. Here's her pitch to voters.
I have over 30 years of experience in and around the industry as an engineer and an attorney.
As a Dallas-based trial lawyer, Castaneda has worked big energy cases, including for big oil and gas players like the late T. Boone Pickens. She's made limiting the practice of flaring gas from oil fields a main part of her campaign. That's when oil companies set fire to methane coming from their wells. It's bad for the environment, and the Railroad Commission lets companies do it all the time. She says she'll try to stop that.
Well, understand that flaring is illegal and has been illegal for over 100 years because it wastes our natural resources.
As far as this year's oil bust goes, Castaneda wants to use the agency's power to limit oil production to stabilize prices. When I ask her why she thinks she's a better choice than her opponent, she goes back to that experience as an engineer and lawyer.
I understand the complexities of the position that I am running for. The solutions aren't easy. The solutions vary by location, by operator, by regulatory framework, by a whole host of factors that make this particular position unlike any other position in state government.
You know, one of the questions that keeps on coming up is who's got the technical experience? We're not going to be the scientists doing the research. We're going to do the policy. We're going to do the governing.
As you might have guessed, this is Castaneda's opponent, Roberto Alonso. He was a state rep from Dallas County for over 25 years. It's that experience that he says makes him the better choice to serve on the Railroad Commission.
I want to come in and give Democrat points of view. Of course, there's going to be two Republicans, and what's going to have to happen, if we can, we come to a working experience.
As far as policy goes, Alonso wants to change the way the commission is funded. Right now, it gets most of its money from industry taxes and permitting fees. He thinks that creates a conflict and wants it funded directly from the state budget.
And, you know, know, one of the things you'll hear, and we will all hear, I mean, as we're going through now, right? There's no money, there's no money, there's no money. There's always money. It's just who gets the money.
He's advocating for limiting industry donations to Railroad Commission candidates. Like his opponent, he also wants to crack down on flaring. Whoever wins the Democratic primary will face off against Republican James Wright in November. Early voting for the Democratic primary runoff is already underway and goes through July 10th. Election Day is July 14th. Moz Bouchel, KUT News.
A handful of congressional races in Texas are getting a lot of national attention and national money. The 10th Congressional District in Texas is one of those. This seat has been held by Republican Michael McCaul since 2005. It's been a pretty reliably red district until the 2018 election, when McCaul won re-election by just 4%. KUT's Claire McInerney reports on the two Democrats on the runoff ballot.
The 10th district runs from northern Travis County to western Harris near Houston. And in Congressman McCaul's first seven elections, he won by at least 10 points. But in 2018, Democrat Mike Siegel came close to beating McCaul, and he's running again.
My policies really reflect what Democrats want to see in Washington, D.C.
Siegel, a former public school teacher and Austin city attorney, calls himself much more progressive than his challenger, Pritesh Gandhi.
And that's a huge distinguishing factor between me and Pritesh. You know, I support a universal healthcare program like Medicare for All. I support a Green New Deal as a way to create millions of jobs confronting climate change. Dr. Gandhi, Pritesh, he opposes both those policies. He's called them fool's gold.
Siegel's progressive policies have earned him the endorsements of Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. He says these policies are what allowed him to come so close to beating McCaul in 2018.
I mean, we're in the crisis of racism and racist policing, something that dates back 400 years in this country. We're also in a health pandemic with the coronavirus. We're in an economic crisis with 45 million newly unemployed. And then, frankly, we're in a crisis of this presidency. And so how do we respond to these crises? To me, this is the moment for progressive solutions.
Pritesh Gandhi, a physician who runs a nonprofit clinic in East Austin, said he voted for Siegel in 2018. He decided to join the race because he thinks if Siegel couldn't win in 2018, when Democrat Beto O'Rourke won that district, then he isn't electable in that area.
And so I'm running because we need a nominee who will fight for what we believe in and who can win, because you cannot make the change that you need to make at the legislative level if you don't have a seat at the table.
Gandhi says it's his campaign that has the better chance of beating Congressman McCaul in the general election in November because his policies appeal to more people in the 10th district.
In the middle of a public health crisis, in the middle of a national reckoning on the original sin of slavery in our country, McCaul does not want to run against a nonprofit physician who is a son of immigrants, a native Houstonian, and a person of color. He stands no chance in the general, and he knows it.
Whoever wins, they'll face McCaul's campaign in the fall that will be well-funded, battle-tested, and ready to win a 9th election. Claire McInerney, KUT News.
The job of a county attorney is not always a flashy one. The office holder is literally an attorney for the county, and they spend a lot of their time fielding legal questions about contracts and other county business. The office also prosecutes misdemeanors, which on average accounted for 2/3 of jail bookings in the last 5 years. And after the death of George Floyd and a larger movement for criminal justice reform in Travis County, KUT's Andrew Weber reports the Democratic runoff for county attorney has found itself in the spotlight.
Both Lori Iserlo and Delia Garza are running on pretty similar platforms. They want to reform Travis County's criminal justice system, and they both want to address that in two big ways: by reducing the number of misdemeanor cases for nonviolent offenses tried by the office, and by speeding up releases for folks who are booked into jail for them. They both want to make attorneys available around the clock for hearings where defendants are read their charges and given a chance to get bonded out before being booked, and they both want to expand diversion programs. But they both come at the office from different angles.
Well, let's start with years of experience. I am a 27-year attorney with a double board certification.
This is Lori Iserlo.
I practice at the state, city, and county level and state and federal court. Ms. Garza is a obviously respected member of city council. She has asserted that this is, quote, a political job, but it's not.
Iserlo has been working at the county attorney's office for 10 years. She argues she's the best fit for the job because of that experience. But Garza argues it is a political office. It's on the ballot, after all. And she says she's effected change as the first Latina to serve on the Austin City Council and the first Latina to serve as mayor pro tem. She says people in her district and countywide want reform.
They're less concerned about how many years somebody has been a lawyer and more concerned about what kind of leader can you be and what kind of change can you bring. And I don't see that kind of transformational change coming from somebody who's just been in that office.
Garza admits she doesn't know the inner workings of the office as well as Iserlo, but she didn't know the inner workings of City Hall when she was elected to the council in 2014 either.
I guess you could say I had been a city employee because I'd been a firefighter, but being a firefighter has nothing to do with City Hall politics and how City Hall works. And so I walked in there, and most elected officials walk into their job having, you know, very little experience on that end.
Looming over the race is the staying power of those who've held the office before. Retiring County Attorney David Escamilla held the job for 17 years. His predecessor, Ken Oden, held it for 18. So this is the first competitive race for county attorney in a generation. Iserlo has sketched out plans to revamp the county's intake for people undergoing a mental health crisis. She wants to empower prosecutors to throw out cases with evidence of police bias. And she's been endorsed by Escamilla. She says she'll be ready immediately if elected.
I have that legal experience to be the county attorney. My team and I are going to be, we are solid and ready to go on day one. And I think that that's critical that the voters understand that.
Garza says her past support of criminal justice reform at City Hall gives her a unique edge. She argues she actually reformed systems, and that's why she wants to come in from the outside to do the same at the county attorney's office, especially in this moment, in this movement for racial justice following the deaths of George Floyd, Mike Ramos, and Breonna Taylor.
And I think it's harder for people from the inside to do that. And I totally understand why. But that's the reality, that most change comes from the outside.
But Iserlo argues in order to bring change, you have to know the institution. She knows it's not an equitable system, and she knows the potential impact of a misdemeanor conviction.
Right now, we have almost 30,000 open misdemeanors, and that's a lot. Every single person who has one of those has a shadow on their record, and I think that we just need to do a better job.
There's no Republican running in November, so this runoff will essentially decide who the next county attorney will be. But there will be a lot of unknowns for whoever wins. That person will have to transition the office to work alongside a new system of public defense for the indigent and the county's new bail system. On top of that, she'll be doing so under the cloud of likely budget cuts due to both the pandemic and a new state law that hamstrings county budgets. Polls are open until 7 p.m. They'll reopen on Sunday until July 10th. Runoff election day is July 14th. Andrew Weber, KUT News.
That's KUT Weekend for the first weekend of July 2020. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org and email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org or just ask me on Twitter. I'm @KUTNathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org.